Howdy folks, this is Shane. Welcome to the In the Blues Tone podcast. This is the first episode for 2017. The years are flying by. Every year I seem to have a little bit less hair on my head, but that's all right. I'm rocking the shaved head look, at least I hope so anyway, but that's beside the point. If you are watching the podcast on YouTube, I post the entire podcast on iTunes. You can search for In the Blues, or you can simply go to inthebluespodcast.com for the entire episode. You don't need a subscription, you just click play and you're good to go. Now, the first thing I wanted to have a chat about was why I didn't go to NAMM this year. I was invited, and I'm going to tell you why I thought it might be best for me to miss it this year and maybe go at a later date. One of the main reasons is I'm not sponsored by any companies. So what I mean by that is no company is going to pay me to go to NAMM to film demos of them or other companies. I do my own thing. I'm not at the mercy of other companies or anything like that, and that's the way that I like it. Other YouTubers work for large companies like guitar companies or distributors that, you know, basically distribute gear out to all the retailers, all that kind of stuff. I'm not one of those guys. All these videos I do from home or at a shop on my own merits. I'm not owned by anybody, and I like to keep it that way. That said, due to this position that I'm in of doing everything myself, I don't have someone flying me over. The cost would have been between, say, $2,500 to $3,500 round trip with accommodation, and there's no way I'd make that back on YouTube for many, many, many months, maybe years. The second reason is it's summertime here and it's beautiful. I live near the beach. It's just a great time to be here. I know California is warm basically all year anyway, but it's an awesome time of the year to be here. There was a couple of other personal reasons why I didn't go. I had my mum's been sick, all that kind of stuff. So I thought it might be best to support her while she was in hospital and take care of her as well. All of the above basically told me, don't go. I don't see any point. There's going to be plenty of YouTubers spamming out videos about NAMM. And generally, a lot of these videos that you see online are pretty poor quality. Most people take their phone or whatever, you know, use the front camera, and it's shaky and wobbly. And not everybody, but there's some good videos out there too. But due to the noise at these places too, it's really hard to like demo an amp and be able to hear it properly, all that kind of stuff. I'd rather just do a demo at home. Much, much easier, better sound quality, better video production, all that kind of stuff. To fly all the way to California for only a few days just didn't really seem like a worthwhile thing for me. Every time I go to the States, I go between 4 and 8 weeks. So that's what I'm going to do. If I go in July, I'm going to be over there for a while shooting some videos of places that I want to shoot videos at in controlled conditions. So I hope that's cool. I hope everyone understands why I didn't go, but I just didn't think it'd be really worth my time. For those who aren't YouTubers, you don't really understand how little we get paid on YouTube. So for those who say, oh, everyone does it for the AdSense revenue has taken a huge drop. In December, I was up 300,000 views to the prior year and down about 40% in earnings, which was pretty awful. So for me to fly all the way to NAMM to make such little back seemed kind of pointless. I love guitar gear. I love doing demos, but I just don't want to be another YouTuber spamming out crap at a massive convention when there's already so many people doing that. I'd like to keep my channel as niche as I can with the stuff that I do. And so you folks, they feel like I'm sort of selling out doing what everyone else is doing. So that's part of the reason as well. I hope that makes sense. Let me know your thoughts in the comments below. I have one tip when you go to buy a new amplifier. Just one. Well, maybe two. Maybe one and a half. But it's one main tip that will save you big time. Anytime you go to buy a new amplifier, take your old amplifier with you. I've spoken about this on a podcast maybe a few years ago now, but I made the critical mistake of not having a reference tone when I bought an amplifier recently. So let me tell you what happened. I was at a shop, nowhere near my house, but I had a guitar in my car. I went and played this amp and I was blown away. I came home and I played my own amp and I thought, yeah, the one that I played was better, much, much better. So the second time I went into the store, I took my Strat and it sounded fantastic, but I was stupid enough in my ultimate gear wisdom and knowledge that I didn't actually take in my amp. I was so sure this amp was going to be the sound I was looking for. So it sounded smooth. I mean, the clean channel, it's a beautiful clean channel. On its own, it sounds fantastic. Now, there's two things that I didn't realize about the tone until I compared it to my other amp, like the Blues Deluxe or the Super Reverb. Is how does it work in a mix? And this is one of those things that you can't predict. The only thing you can do is have an amp that you know sounds great in the mix, live, all that kind of stuff. For those who don't play live, probably it doesn't matter so much, but if you're a live player, certain amps poke out of the mix of a band better than others. My Blues Deluxe is a great example of that. So is the Super Reverb. They're both fantastic. The Hot Rod DeVille 212 with the Celestians, this is a Hot Rod 3, it has an almost too smooth sound. And what I mean by that is it rolled off the tops a little too much. It was a little bit too bassy. I ended up having the bass all the way out. I ended up fiddling with the EQ. I tried everything I could to get this amp to sound the way that I had in my head, and I couldn't do it. It was frustrating. I took it out 3 or 4 times live, and all I was thinking about while I was playing was, this amp's not giving me what I was expecting. And it was shattering in a way, because I just hyped this thing up in my head to be like the ultimate clean tone. It was so nice. And I thought, this is just going to take pedals extremely well and everything else. It also made my pedals sound very, very different and made my pedals sound squishy, which is something they don't do through either of my other two amplifiers. So folks, if you're going to buy another amplifier and you're keeping one and you're not just selling it, take it in, have a listen and do a comparison. Don't ever buy a new amp without having your old one present, because the thing is, I've made this mistake maybe twice now where I bought a 2-Rock thinking it was going to sound better than my Blues Deluxe. I got it home and I preferred the Blues Deluxe. So folks, definitely, definitely take in your old amplifier, take in your pedals, sit down, don't be in a rush, and compare, listen, and see if the amp that you're listening to is giving you something better than what you've already got. Something different isn't always better. And the one critical thing that I guess we can't test is how well are these things going to sound in the mix. And I think that's why it's important to have your old amplifier with you. For those who are into effects pedals, I've come to think of them as the double-edged sword, so to speak, and I'll tell you what I mean about that. They can add to your creativity, they can add to your sound, they can help also define your sound, and also give you inspiration to take things to the next level. I think also it can hinder your playing in some ways as well. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about my thoughts on this. It happened to me personally, and I thought I would share this with you guys to see what you thought of this. So I'm very tone critical, so I like things to be a specific way and not any other way. I like my tone to sound like me, irrespective of what amp I'm plugged into. If I'm using my pedal board, I want it to sound the way I hear it in my head. And whether or not other people like that, I don't care. I like my tone. I like other tones as well, obviously, but I have a particular sound that I can generally nail irrespective of what amp or guitar I'm using. I'm lucky enough to get some great effects sent to me at the In The Blues channel to demo and all of that kind of stuff. And I wanted to make use of these on a larger pedal board. So I upsized my pedal board. I put like 8 effects on there and they all sound fantastic. They absolutely do. It's a great pedal board, but it's huge. So I've got more stuff than I'm used to. So I tended to sort of tap on this, tap on that, you know, see what happens when I put these two pedals on. And this was going on live. And what I found out was I wasn't really focusing on my playing or what was going on around me. I was more concerned about my tone. And this absolutely sort of got in my head and ruined my playing for a small period of time recently. The cure for this for me was to basically go, all right, no effects for a couple of weeks. Just plug into the PV Bandit on the drive channel and just play. Forget about the stomping. Be forced to play and listen and dig in and do everything with my hands as opposed to relying on tap dancing on the floor. As I mentioned earlier, effects pedals will add to the vibe of a live gig and they can take you playing to different places as well as add texture and color, all of that kind of thing. But they can also work against you if you're not familiar with them. So basically, if you're gonna go out playing live, know exactly what this stuff will do before you do it. If you've got an important gig coming up and you wanna change everything on your pedal board, my suggestion is don't do it until after. Make sure that you know what you're going to get out of it before you step on stage. Otherwise, it may affect you more or less than it affected me. I'm not too sure. But the fact was, it really messed with my head. And I felt like I couldn't play because the sound wasn't right. I know that sounds ridiculous, but it actually affected my playing that badly. Please let me know your thoughts on effects pedals and whether you think this is kind of accurate, if you've had this experience before or if you haven't. Let me know your thoughts. Thanks for watching. I recently had a chance to review the Studio Pro 112 amplifier on my YouTube channel, so thanks to my friend Lyndon for allowing me to demo that. It was awesome to give it a go, so thank you so much. And I also had a chance to test it live, and it was absolutely cool. I do a small gig once a month or once every 2 months at a place up in Mornington, and it's an awesome little room, but my Blues Deluxe reissue is just way too big for that room and for that stage, so I had to downsize. The options I have for that room would either be a Princeton, a Blues Junior, the Studio Pro, or something around that size. The Studio Pro just basically stayed clean and it sounded great. I was able to just put my pedal board down on the ground just before I upsized to the bigger pedal board, and I could just basically get my sound. It was no problems at all. Some of the pros of these amps are they're extremely light and easy to get around. They've got a 12-inch speaker. They do have lots of good clean headroom on the clean channel, and it has a very decent drive channel as well. Some of the cons of this amp, which are very few and far between if you are looking for a Studio Pro 112, odds are you already know that the Bandit's out there, so these cons might not actually be cons, but they're food for thought. The cabinet size is smaller than the PV Bandit, so you're not going to get such a a big sound, but that's the way they designed it. It's not supposed to be exactly the same. This 12-inch speaker is actually smaller in terms of the magnet size, so you're not going to get the full depth of sound of the Bandit either. The way I would compare these is the Bandit's kind of like a Blues Deluxe or a Hot Rod Deluxe, and the Studio Pro's a little bit more like a Deluxe Reverb. That would be my comparison. The 6L6 / Bandit would be the bigger, rounder, fuller sound, more clean headroom, all that kind of stuff, whereas the Studio Pro 112 would be a little less headroom, a little less fat sounding, but still sounds great. I mean, who can mock the tones of these amps? They absolutely rock. The only other thing I can think of, at least in my opinion, is the reverb on the Studio Pro 112 isn't as nice as the Bandit reverb. The Bandit reverb has a bigger tank and it just sounds fuller and richer and just a whole lot nicer in my opinion. The reverb on the Studio Pro is pretty nice, but it sounds a little washy and a little thinner in terms of its just tonality. I don't know, but it's food for thought. Everyone likes different things. Some people might prefer that type of reverb over the Bandit reverb, so it's just one of those things. The Studio Pro 112 takes pedals extremely well. As I mentioned, plonked my pedal board down, got my sound. It sounded great. I'll be posting some sound samples of this in a video coming up on YouTube, so stay tuned for that as well. If you do own a Studio Pro 112, please let me know which one you have and your thoughts on the tone of them, and if you've had a chance to compare them to a PV Bandit or any other amplifier. Also leave your comments on YouTube and I'll have a look and get back to you when I can. All in all, the Studio Pro 112 gets the Jewel thumbs up. Good stuff. A friend of mine recently sent me a track he was working on and he said, I need you to go nuts on guitar at the end. And I said, yeah, sure, I'll record my part and send it back to you. Now, recording yourself playing is extremely important and it will bring out all of your flaws. It doesn't matter if you're a guitar player, bass player, drummer, heaven forbid a harmonica player, just kidding all the harp players out there, but it doesn't really matter what instrument you play, you need to record it and listen back. It will bring out all your flaws as a musician and the things that you'll need to work on, as well as also showcasing the things you're already good at, so there's a positive in there as well. For me to cut a guitar solo, I have to go over it again and again until I start to come up with ideas, things that I can remember and sort of hum along in my head and then nail it. One of the things I have trouble with is executing licks on a particular time or speed. And this is one thing I've always struggled with. At a particular tempo, things start to get tricky for me as I'm not a fast player. I have to think of creative ways around that sometimes that still work, but also still feel like the solo is going somewhere. This also forces me to play things that I'm not also comfortable with. So I might do it again and again and again and again until I get it right, which basically is like practice, but it's practice where you have to be perfect in what you're playing or close to perfect, or at least it has to feel good and sound good in context to what's going on. So if this guy puts it on a CD or you put it on a CD, it's there until the end of time. So it's important to really push yourself musically when you record and also learn in ways which to develop your own playing. Recording for me has always been something that I really enjoy, but it's also extremely challenging. I do all of my own production. I do all the audio engineering and mastering and all that kind of stuff as well. So not only am I really critical of the mix of the album, I'm critical of my playing and everybody's parts, all that kind of stuff. So it's a pretty intense sort of headspace when you are recording, but I can't stress enough, even if you're just going to a jam night, take a little MP3 recorder, use your iPhone, whatever, record yourself and see if you are sitting in context to the music or whether or not you're in your own little world. Work on things that you can hear that you need to work on. You might say, oh, my bends are slightly out, or my timing's slightly out, or tempo, or whatever. So these are things that you might not hear unless you hear it back. One thing that most people probably don't know is that I just don't wake up, hit record on my video cameras, and play along to the backing tracks for my demos. Some of those take a long, long time. Some of them might take an hour before I get a take that I'm really happy with. Some days I'll do it in 10 minutes. So inspiration or flow on the day can absolutely vary, but it's about getting consistent. If you can get consistent in your playing and you like what you're hearing back, odds are other people will like it as well. For those of you out there who are guitar players, please let me know your thoughts on whether you think recording and hearing yourself back is advantageous or whether it's a hindrance. Thanks. Why is the Kemper profiling amp so expensive? I've been asking myself this question for quite some time and can't really seem to come up with an answer. Now, before we get into my thoughts on it, and I'm also going to compare it to other amplifiers, I'm going to give you my somewhat informed opinion on what I think about it and its longevity. I don't think these things are going to stand the test of time. I really think they're basically a glorified Fender Mustang amplifier. And before all the haters and people who have purchased it flame me, just listen for a second. I've had a chance to test and use a Kemper profiling amp. A friend of mine has one. A friend of mine has also some of the best Two Rock amps and Super Reverb amps, all that kind of stuff that's available as well. And his intention was to use it for a cover band gig. Now, one thing that I don't get is they don't take pedals well at all. He spent his time fiddling around with his overdrive pedal. It was awful. Like, it just doesn't take pedals the same way that an analog amp would. So if you're a pedal guy, stay clear of this. It also needs an extension foot switch, which is probably another $1,000 on top of the $3,000 that they're charging here, or $4,000 that they're charging for a Kemper profiling amplifier. Now, the difference and gap between the Fender Mustang and the Kemper profiling amp, and that's just one example of these amps, isn't as huge as you think it is. The one thing that the Kemper has going for it that the Fender Mustang doesn't, and this is the only thing, is it can profile other amplifiers. The Mustang comes preset with a whole bunch of profiles from other amps that you can use to basically get any type of sound you want. It has all the effects with there, it comes with a foot switch, all that kind of stuff. The Kemper does not. The Kemper, you get this weird lunchbox size head that's not very practical and also seems like it could get damaged pretty easily as well. I don't like the design of this thing. It's not something you would want to take to a gig, although people do take them to gigs. It's not a gig strong kind of design. It just, not a lot of thought went into this. It's obviously more for the guys who are in the studio. That's the argument. Oh, in the studio, I can do this, I can do that. There's things about it that don't make sense if that's the case. Why does the Kemper profiling amp have 400 watts of power? If it's a studio tool, it really doesn't make a whole lot of sense. 400 watts is overkill. Friend used it live into a 250-watt EV speaker, and the speaker blew. Absolutely just died. It was the loudest amp I've ever heard, but not loud in a pleasing way. It was referencing his Two Rock amp, and his Two Rock amp is much, much nicer to my ear in the same room, and I've got a chance to hear both many, many times. The Kempers don't take analog pedals pretty well. My friend's got everything from a Klon Centaur to the Jan Ray and all these great overdrive pedals. Through the Kemper, it doesn't respond the way that he was used to. Became more of, you know, a control thing where you'd be on the ground trying to find out how to get this thing to sound good. Now, before you say, oh, it's his playing, this guy's a pro, he tours, he plays in front of 20,000 people, this was supposed to be a practical idea, take this thing with you, plug it in, and you're good to go. And it does do that extremely well. One of the strengths of the Kemper is you can just plug it straight into a PA speaker, and it sounds great, it really sounds good, but you can also do that with the Fender Mustang as well. I know there's going to be a lot of people that basically stand up for the Kemper and everything about the sort of rich boy tools of the trade that you can get and sort of the high-end snobbery that goes along with it, but I don't see the Kemper being that dissimilar to a Fender Mustang. And if it was up to me, if I was to take one of two of these to the gig, I'd take the Fender Mustang. Built-in speaker, throw it into the back of the car. I could get knocked around. I could put my drink on it. Not that I'm that kind of guy, but you could put a drink on it and not stress. I hate the design of the Kemper. Not a lot of thought went into the practical side of this, taking it to a gig All the controls stick out from the front. Lots of things that I don't really understand how it can be used as a live tool as much as it would be a studio tool, and why it needs 400 watts. Seriously, like, what's the point of that? This isn't to flame the Kemper Profiling Amp fans out there. If you like it, you like it. I'm not going to say it's a piece of shit, but what I am going to say is it shouldn't be as expensive as it is for what you're paying. And I don't expect these things to last or stand the test of time. Anyone who buys one, tell me they're going to get rid of all their analog amps. Not a chance. My prediction is most people that buy these things, if they're not a studio owner, will basically just go back to playing their analog amplifiers because it will give them what they want. All right, this next topic is about owning multiple guitars of any one type. So for example, two Strats or two Tellys or two Les Pauls or two whatevers. I've been in a position where I've owned more than one Strat, for example, and I tended to always want to go and play one of those two Strats, or one of those three Strats, or one of those two Telecasters when I owned two Tellys. I owned a 52 reissue, which I still have, and a Classic Vibe, which was great. I also owned a G&L Telecaster, which was also a great guitar, but I tended to opt for the 52 reissue. So that's basically my number one Telly. My number one Strat is my white Mexican Strat. It's the only Strat that I've got. Not to say that I won't buy another one, but the thing is, through this process of subconscious elimination, you tend to pick the one that you like the best and stick with it on the most part. The only other time I would use one of the other guitars, for example, is if the strings on my main one was starting to go and I had a gig, I'd take a different guitar with fresher strings if I was too lazy to actually swap them out. This has also come up with Les Pauls. I've owned a few different Les Pauls at one time, always played one over the other. Same with Little Crow guitars as well. I've had two Little Crows, always ended up going back to this black one. For those who are watching on YouTube, you can see this is my SD Corvino, the original one. The other Corvino was great. I just preferred this one for whatever reason. So one is enough. The next part of this discussion is it possible to have one guitar to rule them all in your collection? So one guitar that you'll use over any of your other guitars whenever possible, whether you're playing live or recording or sitting at home, do you pick up one guitar over all of them? For me, this is a tough thing to answer. I go through phases musically with guitars. There's times I like my Tele, there's times I like my Strat, there's times I think I want to play a 335 until the end of time, but I end up not doing that. So for me, I chop and change quite a bit. I think through this process of elimination, I've pretty much got my collection down to just one of the essential guitars for me and my collection. And I think there's three main ones for me now. This Little Crow SD Corvino, my Strat, and my 52 reissue Telecaster. That's not to say I don't love my Tokai guitars. They're awesome guitars. But the thing is, these are the three that pretty much speak to me and the sound that I get. It's taken me a long time to kind of work that out. I've come back to the basics. For the type of music that I write, the kind of music that I play, I can get pretty much the tones that I want through any of these three guitars based on my mood. Let me know your thoughts. Do you have a number one or do you have many number ones? The question I beg to you is whether or not it's worth having a huge collection of cheap guitars. Resale value's low. Getting them, having to fix certain things on some of them might work fine, but odds are you'll probably want to modify these guitars, maybe put different pickups in, maybe change the pots or even something like the nut or whatever, the bridge might be faulty, maybe a switch doesn't work properly, or maybe you want to do some upgrades that might not cost a lot, but some might cost a lot. So the question is owning a lot of cheap guitars actually a valuable thing as a guitar player? The other part of this question is, would you take any of these cheaper guitars over a more expensive guitar to a gig or to a recording session or whatever it is that you do, whether or not you're playing at home? Would you pick up a cheaper guitar over, say, a more expensive one that's sitting right next to it? How many cheap guitars is too many cheap guitars? If you own more than, say, 10 cheap guitars, you've probably also spent the same amount of money that you could buy, say, one to two really, really nice guitars, whether they're used or new, depending on what type of guitar you're looking at. One of the benefits I see of buying and testing out cheaper guitars is, say you've been thinking of buying a Cabernet style guitar, but you can't actually afford to get the Fender. You could then, say, buy a cheaper version or an imitation one of these, just to check out if it's something that you might want to do. It's kind of one of those steps, though, that's still going to cost you a couple of $100 just to work that out. What's the resale value going to be on that guitar? You might lose $100, you might only lose $50. just depends on what it is you've bought. So you're sort of going to be out of pocket irrespective. If you do then decide to go and buy the more expensive guitar or the one that you thought you wanted, guess what? You have to spend more money again. There's a middle ground to guitars that I would highly recommend, and I wouldn't start any lower than, say, the Squire Classic Vibe series if you're a Fender guy, or the Mexican Standard stuff. Both of those type of lines of guitars are both extremely good. Squire is actually making quite a lot of great guitars right now as well. If you're a Gibson fan, you probably want to go for an Epiphone. There's other brands that sort of imitate that as well. But, you know, if you're a Gibbo fan, or that's what we call it in Australia, Gibson fan, a Gibbo fan, check out the Tokai stuff as well. Plenty of good alternatives to spending a lot of money on a Gibson. And these things are still very, very playable. You could get a great second-hand Japanese guitar for pretty much the same price as a new Epiphone as well. So keep those in mind as well. There's lots and lots of great guitars out there, but some of them are just hit and miss. And I've been bitten on the ass a couple of times by spending money on a guitar that I just shouldn't have bought. And it was an absolute piece of junk, and I shouldn't have done it. I should have just put the money into a more expensive guitar, which I did at a later date, but I was still out of pocket the money I spent on the crap guitar. So think about that. If you're semi-serious about playing guitar and it's something that you're going to do for a while, my suggestion would be, as I mentioned, to go for that middle ground of stuff or higher. Sometimes owning lots of cheap guitars won't really do it for you musically. It might just fill a gap in a collection if you say, I need a Telecaster, but I don't care, I'll just get a cheap one because I'm not going to play it very often. Then maybe that's an option, or maybe just don't buy it. That's food for thought. Let me know your thoughts on cheap guitars and whether or not it's worth adding them to a collection of guitars, and whether or not you'd actually play them over more expensive guitars if you had both available. Thanks for listening. My name's Shane. This has been the In the Blues Tone podcast, the first one for Jan 2017. I absolutely appreciate everyone who supports me on YouTube and also on Facebook and Instagram, all that kind of stuff. I've got some exciting new news coming up pretty soon about a new YouTube channel that I've started with a friend. It's in a completely different area to music, but it gets me out of the house and it's going to be a lot of fun. I've just finished a new video, or almost finished editing this new video, and it's awesome. So it won't be what anyone expects. It's going to be a whole lot of fun. Don't forget, folks, if you like what I do here at In the Blues, you can support me at Patreon/InTheBlues. And even a $2 donation a month would go a very long way at keeping me afloat during the year. YouTube is just crap for trying to make a living. It really, really is. And even a $2 donation a month, and I don't expect any more than that, would go a long way. So if you are interested in supporting In the Blues, then feel free to do that. And anyone who supports me on Patreon, I'll also post a video just to Patreon as well that only members can see, and that'll be once a month as well. So thanks so much, folks, and I'll catch you all very, very soon. See ya.